Horizon Christian Fellowship in Fitchburg, Massachusetts, Sunday, December 9th, 2012.
Hey, let's say a word of prayer, and we'll pick up here in Daniel chapter 11, where we left off last week, which is verse 21. Father, I thank you that we can meet in this place, as we considered even last service, we meet here freely. And this place, I think of all the work that went in to just even make it possible, Lord, years of construction, to even get up here on the third floor. I remember it being such a hard work, and those of us that were around then thinking, would we ever even accomplish it? Could we do it? And it was something you wanted to do, and you did it, and here we are, we meet in this building, Lord. And I thank you for that. And then I think of the radio then calling us later to build these stations, and it's been the same sort of feel, just impossible. Much bigger than we are. And yet somehow, God, you just continue to do it. And as we gather here, Lord, there's a radio station in Derry, New Hampshire. Churches have been planning on for a good number of years now, and it expires in a week. I'd ask for the favor to have this little team we have get it on the air, or at least license it and get it done, and to a point where it needs to be done before we lose the license. So I ask for your favor. I ask, too, Lord, for the station in Rhode Island, that little part that's finally been figured out would be replaced and it'd get on and lead about this 50,000 watt upgrade at the Cape, lead about this moving the station to the John Hancock, lead about the station up in the Lakes region. Your will be done, Lord. But I know you do the impossible, and we don't want to step anywhere you don't want us to go. We don't want to yet lack the faith for somewhere you want us to go. It's such a time, God. Be with us and bless us. Protect this church in this time. Give us a growing unity, and especially a love for our own community and the lost all around us. But as we study these verses, I ask, Lord, you'd remind us about the age we live in. We don't have a lot of time, it's clear. I pray you stir our hearts. May your spirit be upon all of us, even myself. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Daniel chapter 11. We left off last week with verse 21, just a reminder where we've been. Daniel, I believe, is writing this around 536 or so BC. He's a Jew. He's in Babylon. At this particular time, he's lived the entire time. The Jews, God disciplined his people. He said he would. If they got far from him, he'd take them out of the land. And they got far from him, and he took them out of the land 70 years. He said he'd take them to Babylon, and he did. Daniel's lived through that entire time. God also said at the end of the 70 years, he'd allow them to return. Cyrus, at this particular time, is now the leader of Persia. Persia's conquered the Babylonians. In an amazing way, Isaiah, back in 700 BC, Isaiah, God this spoke through this prophet and said there would be this man, Cyrus, that God would use to give favor to the Jews. And he's living at this time now, and he's let the Jews begin to go back to Babylon, Jerusalem. Well, even during this time of discipline, while they were in the area of Babylon and captives and slaves, God gave favor because he took some of the Jews and even put them in high places. Daniel's one of them. He's raised them up high in government. This young man, now an old man, but a man of God, and at times God has even come to him, given him, as you've studied with me, visions, interpretations of dreams that the leaders of Babylon have had and so forth. And now this is this last vision that we have where God came to him and just gave him a vision. An angel appeared to him. This vision has been similar to some of the other details that he saw earlier, and the reason why they're important to know. Back at the beginning of the chapter, this man is in the time here of Cyrus the king, but God then showed him there'd be a few more great kings under the Persian Empire, verse 2. After that, we've already seen this in earlier visions he had too, there'd be this great king that would come out of Greece, this Greek empire would arise and would dominate the world. That man would die quickly, and four, not his offspring, but four people would replace him. His kingdom would be divided in four. Verses 3 to 4, we talked about that. Alexander the Great, the four generals that replaced him when he died as a young man. And then the chapter focuses on what would be two of those generals that become kings or dynasties. And it focuses on those dynasties over a period of about 150 years or so. That is the Seleucid Empire, which is Syria. And then what is Egypt, the south, the Ptolemies. And why? Why the focus? I mean, why the history lesson? Why the focus into the future? Well, the reason being is in between Syria and Egypt is Israel. Palestine. The Jews have gone through a tremendous time of discipline and suffering. They're going back to their land now, but it isn't like the program's over. It isn't like the Messiah is going to show up now and all, it's just going to be a life of bliss. No, there's a bigger plan. There's more work God's going to do. And yes, they're going to go back, plant vineyards. Yes, they're going to go back and have houses and establish themselves, but there are going to be hard days still ahead. And this period, God especially wants them to understand, to give them hope. You know, this word, the Bible that we have, as we'll see even next week, I mean, of course, it includes things about the future from today. And imagine being a Christian and believing in the Lord, that you need Jesus for forgiveness and salvation, but you knew nothing else. Nothing else was given to us. No sense of what happens next. No sense of direction or future. That's just it. Believe in Jesus. What would life be like for us? Well, amazing that God has given us a Bible that also speaks about the big picture and the events of the future and where it's all going. Well, in the same way, the Jews now that are going back, this mighty man of God, God's given him a vision, had an angel come to him, give him vision to say, here's what's going to happen down the road, you need to know. And it's all with a word of hope, but man, the road is difficult. The road is difficult. Major suffering as they're caught in between wars of nations and brutal kings. So we have the privilege of studying this. Now remember last week, I made the point. If Daniel saw these things before they happened, there's no book like the Bible. As you remember, there are critics that say, well, there's no way. Even we quoted one from the 3rd century AD who looked at this, said, there's no way this man saw these events before. This was written after. Well, of course, I believe it happened before, 530. And we've been given the detail, the reasons why, as we've been going along, why this happened before, why clearly this was written before. You saw some of that last week. We might know a little bit this week. But if he did, every verse is another step into the future. Every verse is a little bit more detail of events in the future. And every verse is all the more improbable and impossible of anybody being able to say that so accurately as we go through again today. And for that reason, there are people who say, nope, written after, and here's why. And we have our response because the Bible, you don't throw your brain away, man. The Bible is a book that God gave us, and man, it stands the test. And we've been talking about that all along, given the reasons as to why and the proof for that. Well, we pick up verse 21. We left off. There's a change. Remember, you've got these battles of the northern kingdom, the southern kingdom, Antiochus, and that dynasty, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. Israel's caught, the Jews suffer in between. Well, now we are focused on the dominance of the north kingdom, and we pick up with this particular king, verse 21. And in this place shall arise a vile person to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. Now, I'm going to just read this a verse at a time and explain it because it's sort of like a history lesson for us because we're in 2012. Well, the author, Daniel, of course, the angel tells him there's going to be then this vile person in the northern kingdom that he raised up. What we're seeing now is more detail on what we've seen before earlier, Daniel chapter 7, another time period where a few years before God appeared and gave vision to Daniel. And what we have here, this next major heading, is this vile king of the north, which is, we know now the name of this man historically, is Antiochus Epiphanes, Antiochus IV. He reigned from 175 to 164 BC. You look at his reign, you read what follows, it parallels exactly with this man. A vile person, he usurps power, meaning, as it says there in verse 21, he's not somebody who would normally be given the throne. And that is Antiochus Epiphanes, we know, was a brother of the late previous king, but not somebody in line for the throne. And as we'll discuss, this man could talk well. This man was good with words. His personality, the charisma, he was persuasive. And he just worked people against people and eventually works it so that he gets into the place of power and then continues to do that with nations and against the people and against the Jews, even Jews against Jews. Now it says he's a vile person. The word is loathsome, disgusting. The truth is, there's probably never been. I mean, there has been, but he's in a club of a few. I mean, he is as vile as they get. This dude is vile, man. We'll see as we go. Initially, he took the title Theos Epiphanes, which means God manifests in the flesh. You look at the coins from his rule. Initially, you'll see his head on a coin. Later, there's then like the sun or the star above his head. This man began to believe, or at least try to get the people to believe, that he was some sort of divine God, sent by God or something. But persuasive, making promises, speaking cool words, getting into position of authority and prominence, and then the real heart coming out. The Jews in time, his contemporaries, Epiphanes, the word Epimenes is very close in sounding, and they called him Epimenes, which means madman. Madman. But initially, he came peacefully. He was a deceiver. We're told he didn't use terror or the sword so much to get the throne, but he used flattery. Flattered the king of Pergamus and his brother, got their assistance. Flattered the Romans, sent ambassadors to court their favor, paid them arrears and tribute, get their favor. Flattered the Syrians, gained their cooperation, and so forth. And he seized the king by intrigue, meaning he was not, as I mentioned, a descent to the throne, but through political maneuverings, took one brother against another brother, just speaking to them, pitting them against, dividing a family and so forth, pitting one brother against another. And there is some historically that suggests that he killed one of the brothers. But anyhow, he ends up getting the throne in Syria, Antiochus Epiphanes. And that's not a good deal for the people of God when he does. Now you look at that sort of pattern, right? A guy who's a deceiver, speaks well, doesn't show his colors until he's in position. Man, that's happened throughout history, right? I mean, you just got to study history. I've been reading recently Hitler. Just fascinating. It fascinates me to go back in history. Read about these people. Who were they? What were they like? Where'd they come from? How did they get there? Sort of thing. Well, Hitler is an example of that. Early 30s, I was reading. Early 30s, when he was 30, 31, so forth. This man had a tremendous hatred already developing for the Jews. I mentioned that before. That happened at a young age with this man. But he came across the Nationalist Socialistic German Workers' Party. Very small party, only had 100, 200 people. But as he got to know these people, he began to focus politically on them because they had similar Jews, anti-Semitic sort of Jews. Well, the point is, though, if you read his history, this guy could talk, man. There's something about his personality. He could smooth people. He could work people. So what he began to do with his little group of 100, 200, he began to be their spokesperson. He began speaking. And when he spoke, crowds would come. Crowds of 1,000, 2,000 people would come and listen to this guy. So he's raising money. Started to raise money for the party. Well, he was in the army at the time we got discharged. He just continued to do that, raised up the money and the influence with his people, and eventually of this little party, he became what was called their Führer, their absolute leader, and then with that began to influence beyond their borders as far as into the culture of Germany. But a guy who could talk the talk, man. A guy who could just somehow get people's attention. Antiochus Epiphanes built out of that same sort of deal. You look at what's happening with the Muslim Brotherhood. Morsi, Egypt. You know, just a little bit ago, if you study the Muslim Brotherhood, they certainly have been around a long time. Generally, previous rulers of Egypt have had a very poor opinion of them. They've kind of been off to the side, not so much a terrorist group, but a bad group, a group with an ideology that's extreme. Even just a little bit in Cairo, just a little bit ago, I mean, just a few years ago, maybe one office in Cairo and on the door was just a little business card to tell you what was inside. Not a significant organization, but some shrewd leaders. So when the Muslim or the Arab uprising started to happen, they started to make their moves, make some public declarations, make some promises, and what began to happen? In a short time, man, these people, the Muslim Brotherhood, with this guy Morsi winning the presidency of Egypt, they get into political control in the land. Well, they've made the right promises. They talked well. They did the right deal. Now they're in control. What starts to happen? And as we referenced recently on Thanksgiving, Morsi sends shockwaves through the nation, issuing a presidential decree effectively challenging any other law against him. This is the decree exactly. The president can issue any decision or measure to protect the revolution. The constitutional declarations, decisions, and laws issued by the president are final and not subject to appeal. Well, he suddenly comes down with a law. No matter what I declare, it's final, period. Well, as you know, then people around the world say, what? What? And then others came out, people within even the church, saying, we've been telling you all along, these guys are extreme. They've been lying all along. Well, people coming out calling like he wants to be a new Pharaoh. And so you see the clashes in the last couple weeks on the news. Egyptians that were part of this uprising now are getting, what Morrissey, what is he doing, man? We got rid of this sort of thing. And I know just recently, the last couple of days, he's kind of backed off a little bit, some of these statements and some of these policies. But the thing is, he's only showing his colors now, that he's in position and authority. That's an Antiochus Epiphanes from a long time ago, and that's what we're reading. Verse 22, with the force of a flood, they shall be swept away from before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant. So this force of flood, you know, people being swept away. This man invades Egypt twice. He does it a third time. We'll talk about it. Of course, the north, the south, the southern empire. He actually, in an amazing way, his first two times has tremendous success against the Egyptians. And this force of a flood being swept away, you'll see as we go on, he's referring to the Egyptians. But then there's this statement about the prince of the covenant also being swept away. Well, who's the prince of the covenant? The prince of the covenant is in the indefinite sort of grammatical tense. It could literally be said a covenant prince. And of course, the covenant is the covenant of God. As we know, we're studying the Bible in the context, and the prince of that covenant is the high priest. Well, Daniel says this before, centuries before, Antiochus Epiphanes comes in, and with a flood, I guess you could say, takes out the high priest, Ananias the Third, 175 BC. This man, this Syrian king, decides, hey, you're no longer the Jewish high priest. Your brother Jason is. We find out historically the reason why Jason got the job, why he did the switch, is because Jason paid him a lot of money. Jason also wanted to bring the Greek culture to the Hebrew nation, and as you study the Bible, he's very successful in doing that. You got to the time of Jesus, you got the Hellenistic Jews. We talk about the Greek culture, the Septuagint Bible, Greek translation of the Old Testament. Well, the high priest, Ananias III, was then a few years later assassinated. So, taking just the verses one at a time, totally lining up with what happened historically. Now, so what you have here is you have a foreign king, a Syrian civil king, now messing with the nation spiritually, the Jews. Obviously, that's a big deal. That's why they need to know about this time. When the government comes in, interesting, this begins here. The Romans that are now growing as a strong nation that will become the Roman Empire, 30 BC, they just follow suit with the same sort of thing. We study that in the Gospels. The Romans, the civil, foreign government now playing politics with the Jews and having a spiritual situation as far as influencing that, seeking to do that. Of course, that has gone on all along. It's happened throughout history. And, you know, living here now in the United States of America, man, I think as we go along, we shouldn't be surprised if we began to feel the same way. You know, we are in a country that freedom of religion, right? Freedom of religion, that was the big part of what happened here, starting with the pilgrims. But I think as we go along, we're going to find not long from now that we're, as Christians, are going to feel, is there really freedom of religion anymore? Can't say that publicly. That's now a hate crime. Can't say what the Bible taught here. That's now what it just, I think more and more as we go along. I think it's going to be challenged, and I think it's because of the bigger picture of what the Bible says. I think we're going to find if that is something that happens. And that, by the way, is one of the reasons why I think this little window for radio and why so much of it's happening repeatedly so quickly, build these stations. I think there's a little window. I remember years ago sitting down with my kids at home and had a book of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a little kid's story of his life, and was reading it to my kids. Hadn't read it before, and it was enjoyable, and I'd read it to them, and got to this one section, and there was the story of when he was on the radio in Nazi Germany as a Christian, teaching, sharing, but also exhorting the Germans, hey, this worship of Hitler is bad news, man. And the story goes, I don't know how they did it. Maybe they went to the tower site, but the Nazis, while he, one time, right in the middle of it, was declaring certain things, they turned the power off and knocked him off the air. And of course, not too long later, he ended up in prison. I think I don't know the future. I'm just a little goofball, but I read these things and I look around the signs of the times. I wonder where it's going, man, in America as far as the freedom of religion. But if perchance we find we have less and less freedom in a pluralistic, socialistic, liberal sort of culture when it comes to our religious freedom, hey, man, welcome to planet Earth, right? It's happened all along. We've been in a unique time, really. It's happened all along. You know, I make this point then because building some of these radio stations, I'll be honest with you, at times, and I think people look at me too and feel that, but there's so much to do, and just there's enough to do in our church, and I, at times I've told God, God, this is hard, man. I don't get it. Why does it have to be this way? I mean, there's enough going on in the church. This radio, if we had more money and more people and bigger staff, it wouldn't be such a hard thing. It always seems to be impossible. It's always hard. What do we do, God? What do we do? And I felt that. And I've sat down at times even saying that to God. And more than once, maybe you've had this experience with God. I share that with the Lord and God comes back. Dude, you haven't seen anything yet. You're not really. You need to grow up, man. I mean, for instance, I've thought that, prayed it, wrote it in my journal, and this is my Bible reading for the day as I open my Bible where I would be next. If you have run with the footmen and they have wearied you, then how can you contend with horses? And if in the land of peace, in which you trusted they wearied you, then how will you do in the floodplain of the Jordan? And I've just felt in my heart as if God had said to me in my heart, dude, these are the good times, man. This is the easy time. So my wife and I joke now. We kind of, hey, these are the good days. You know what I mean? These are the good old days. Is it going to be possible in the future looking back going, hey, remember when we used to just have the radio and could say whatever we wanted in the public sphere? And remember thinking back, because it won't be that like that in the future. You never know. These could be the good old days, right? You're thinking, it's so hard. It's so hard. And you're going to be thinking, oh, remember those great times? It was so great back then. I've had the Lord, I feel, put that in my heart. Verse 23, after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. Historically, Antiochus Epiphanes adopted a policy of friendship with Egypt. Again, flattery, treaty sort of situation. But then with that, broke that, attacked him and undermined him. Even one of his nephews, remember there's a relationship, family relationship between the two empires. One of his nephews was ruling in Egypt, using him against another to advance his own interests, sort of thing. As it says, for he shall come up with a small number of people. That's the way it started. It didn't seem so significant, you know, I guess, as far as humbling Egypt and his power against Egypt. But as he would collaborate and flatter and subdue an area, he would then use that to maybe take the spoil, as we're going to read, and give it to others and win votes and just continue on and really become quite a monstrosity, quite a powerful entity. Verse 24, he shall enter peacefully even into the richest places of the province, and he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches, and he shall devise his plan against the strongholds, but only for a time. Well, as it says there, he shall enter the land peacefully. He'll do what his fathers haven't. That is those others, part of that dynasty, the Seleucid dynasty. We've seen the wars south and north. We've seen the dominance of the south. Now the north is beginning to be strong, but with him, the north has all along wanted to go down there and get those treasures of Egypt, subdue Egypt. And he, more than those before him, twice comes in and really humbles Egypt, taking treasures and spoils from Egypt. And that's what's being referred to in the future now for you historically, for you and I to read. As we know what happened historically. As it says, he shall disperse among the plunder and the spoil and the riches. That's what he did. I mean, he would conquer a territory. And then he'd spread the wealth with people around there. Hey, just to get the popularity and the votes, you know. And with that, he gained the name Munificent. Or liberal, which he's just the nice liberal benefactor, Antiochus Epiphanes. No, the dude was vile, buying the votes. You know, I read that and I think of our own country. You know, this last election, man, I just wondered. You know, man, are we buying votes? We buying votes? I look at before the election, Obama saying $800 billion in taxes. That's what we need to do. $800 billion in taxes. That's just before the election. He gets voted, $1.6 billion in taxes, $1.6 billion in tax increases, trillion. And I'm like, that's 100% increase, just before and after. What's up, man? That's a 100% increase. I noticed too, came out recently on one of the websites, the poll was done in the Democratic Party, and that a majority, it was a small majority, but a majority, like 54.5% of Democrats have a favorable view of socialism. Well, if you would talk to Americans, the older Americans, we don't have a favorable view of socialism. We want freedom. Freedom. Not a big government. When you have socialism, you have massive government to regulate every area of our life. Verse 25, he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south of the great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army. But he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. And we know he prepared his second invasion. He prepared a long time for it of Egypt. You can read about it in the Maccabees, those books. He defeated Egypt in that particular battle. And after the victory, the Ptolemy, the king of Egypt, surrendered into his hands. In verse 26, so the south raised up against him, but he defeated him. That's what's being referred to there, I believe. Verse 26, yes, those who eat of the portion of his delicacies shall destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. Part of the reason why he, the second time, humbled Egypt is that he worked this way of flattery, and there were people within Egypt that supported him and deserted to him. And so by treason and people that were with the other king that ate his delicacies that would normally be submissive to the other king joined with him. Well, verse 27. But these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table, but it shall not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time. And what we know is historically is Antiochus and the Ptolemy at the time, sitting at the same table, there's historical information. The two kings would meet at Memphis, meet at times and discuss. Antiochus, the smooth guy, you know, his nephews, it's essentially his nephew that's ruling down in the south. There's a family relation. And he would pretend to take care of him and want to help him in his nation. And that guy would then pretend, hey, I want your help. And they would kind of lie to each other. Antiochus thinking, I'm going to just flatter you and I'm going to come in and get it all. And the other thinking, I'm just saying nice things too because I'm going to work with my brother back here in Egypt and we're not going to let you in. What happened is eventually it led to open war. Verse 28. While returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the holy covenant, so he shall do damage and return to his own land. That's why we have this again. And this is what happens. God's saying this to the Jews as they're going back. You need to know about some hard times again coming. Here's the hope, the big picture. Antiochus Epiphanes, second time. Now, depending on how you look at the history, sometimes there's a focus on only two invasions or the three invasions. Seems to me that it's three invasions. This particular time, he's come back from victory. His heart is prideful as he comes back, passing through Israel, back on his way to Syria. He turns against the Jews, as it says, against the Holy Covenant, and he does damage. And he does indeed. He oppresses the Jews. This is fulfilled on his way when he was going back that he killed many Jews in Jerusalem. And evidently, Jason, he had put in his high priest. Now Syria's away. Antiochus is busy with the Egyptians. Jason, political pressure around him. Hey, man, you're for them. You're not for us. Decides to seek with the Jewish people to put off the Syrians, some sort of insurrection. Antiochus Epiphanes knows about it as he comes in. He just kills a ton of people and really pummels the Jews. So, point is, they're just caught in the middle. They're just caught in the middle between two warring nations, God's people here suffering. It happens around the world. You can be a Christian living in China today. You're just a Christian living in China, but you suffer because you're a Christian. You can be living in Sudan, and there's some sort of Islamic government. You're a Christian. You love God. But because of what's going on in the north and south, you suffer. You suffer because of governments. Same sort of deal. Same sort of encouragement to the Jews. And certainly it's something that's repeatedly happened. This is just a picture of so often history. Verse 29, the last verses we'll look at this morning. We'll stop at verse 35. At the appointed time, he shall return and go towards the south. But it shall not be like the former or the latter. This, I believe, is his third time coming in against the Egyptians. We know historically. And as it says, it's not like the other times, meaning The other two times, he humbles them, takes great spoil. He wants all of Egypt. He gets as far as Alexandria, never gets the whole ticket, though. He's coming the third time, and what happens? He's defeated, and he's humbled. And it's because of verse 30. For ships come from Cyprus, for ships from Cyprus shall come against him, therefore he shall be grieved, and return in rage against the Holy Covenant, and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. He goes down this third time, the Romans, the Egyptians appeal to the Romans. Rome is not an empire, the Roman Empire yet, that is 30 BC, but they are a growing mighty world and have been for a while. The Egyptians appeal to the Romans, the Romans send their navy, they defeat Antiochus' navy. And then they send this man, I'll do my best with the Latin here, Opelius Linnaeus. I never took Latin, so that's the best I can do. But they send him to Antiochus at Alexandria with a demand from the Roman Senate that he stop and go home and cease his expedition in Egypt. And the story goes that Linnaeus took and drew a circle around him on the sand. And you'll see this in history. Historical lessons. And this man said, this Roman said to Antiochus Epiphanes, make up your mind before you leave this circle or you'll face the full power of Rome. Well, with that, this man was humbled. He goes back to Syria. From that point, it's huge. It's his demise, meaning he's now under the Roman thumb, Roman dominion and authority. His time is going out, you know. But on his way back through Jerusalem and Israel, Jews, you need to know this, this man will be in a rage. And what he will do. And the reason why it's also here is because of a future event. This man is like the Antichrist in what he does. Like more than anybody else. As it says, in rage, he'll rage against the Holy Covenant. And he just unleashed his frustration on the Jews as he went through with all sorts of violence. Now as it's recorded there in verse 30, he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. Jason has been there as the high priest. For a part, seeking to Hellenize, bring the Greek culture, have them turn away from their Hebrew roots, turn to the Greek ways, having some success. So when Antiochus Epiphanes comes through, there are those that have gone that way that embrace him and join him. And that's what's being referred to in verse 30. Verse 31, and the forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. And if you read the Bible, that term, abomination of desolation, has significance, right? Jesus spoke of it. Paul wrote about it. The abomination of desolation. This man, as he comes in, he goes to take over the temple, removes all of the Hebrew way of worship completely, then takes an image of Zeus in the holies of the temple, sets it up, eventually then takes a pig, sacrifices it on the altar, completely defiles the Jewish temple, and then even forces Jews to sacrifice pigs. Those that refuse to do that, he puts to death. There begins to be a big slaughter of the Jews. And it's this abomination of desolation, meaning it's so wicked what he does, it caused a desolation of the temple in that way. Well, you may remember this picture of what happened here. Jesus says this is like a prophetic. What happened historically is like a prophetic picture of what's going to happen in the future. Jesus, speaking of the future Antichrist, said this, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of by Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, then flee to the wilderness. Jesus, after this, two centuries, says, when you Jews see in your temple the abomination of desolation, run for the hills. And then we know, as Paul in 2 Thessalonians, we put all the scriptures together, we understand there's going to be another man, an Antiochus Epiphanes, man, the Antichrist, a man who will use what's going on. He'll have smooth words, man. He'll have charisma. He'll get the crowds. He'll just have the way. He'll say the right thing in the right way. And the table will be set as nations begin to come together in a unified way. He will work the system, and he'll put himself right in the center and become the center of the world power. And as he does, in time, what he'll do, because of Jerusalem and the spiritual, he'll do the same. He will go down. He'll have a false prophet who will set up an image in the area there to have them turn and worship this great leader. In fact, he will go to the temple and set up himself and demand to be worshipped. And we understand from the scripture is that at that time he was essentially possessed with a devil, that Satan himself, it's Satan's ploy to be the Messiah, to get the world, worship him at his, bend the knee before him is what he'll do. But when that happens, there's a big plan that God has been working from the beginning, the destruction of evil and sin and the devil from the beginning, the establishing of his own, bringing his own people, saving them out and making his own kingdom. What will happen at that point in the middle of what we call the Great Tribulation, it's as if when he does that, the wrath of God now can come down. It'll just be the switch. And the wrath of God will come for 3.5 years like never before on this planet. Just a shakening of this world and an awakening of the nation of Israel, the Jews, to their Messiah, Jesus. Well, Daniel speaks of this, Antiochus Epiphanes. Jesus, Paul says, there's an abomination of desolation coming. This is why it's here, for the Jews then, for us now, for the Jews in the future. Now, as it says here, those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. He has hearts of Jews and that have turned from God. He exploits them and brings them on his team. But there will be people in the midst. There'll be Jews, this is what it's saying, who'll make a stand. And we know that's exactly what happened historically. In fact, we commemorate it on December 25th. The world does, the Jewish nation, Hanukkah, because that is what happened. Matthias, father of 5 sons, refuses to offer sacrifices in this profane manner. In fact, he even stands up and kills the king's agent at the time. He and his sons then flee to the mountain and begin the famous Maccabean revolt. You have the book of Maccabees, who, especially 1 Maccabees, is historically accurate. So his son, he's got these sons, Judas Maccabees especially, starts with a small group, and they began to rise up against the Syrians and Antiochus Epiphanes. Initially, they're armed with sticks. But they come, and they begin to assault Syrian outposts and so forth, and they start to have success. As they have success, some of the Jews that were on the side join in, and what happens is they gain a strength, and they begin to push back the Assyrians, and eventually Antiochus Epiphanes and his generals and so forth, they begin to defeat. But as they do, the costs are great. It says they do great exploits. This is centuries before. It is exactly what happened. And those are the people who understand shall instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by the sword and flame, by captivity and plunder. Well, there'll be those that are wise. You can study in 2 Maccabees like Eleazar, an old scribe that began to stand up. Hey, man, we need to turn back to Judaism, the temple and the temple worship. We need to get right with God. That's why these things have happened and so forth. Begins to seek a spiritual revival. Well, as the Maccabean revolt becomes stronger, they eventually drive to Jerusalem. They get Jerusalem. They get the temple. And then you have this revival that began to happen where they begin to cleanse the temple, set up the worship again, the sacrifice as well. They come to light the menorah. And what happens is as they light it, there's only enough oil for one day. That's all they have. Well, they light it anyway. Well, the whole purification and preparation of oil takes 7 days. They've got one day, they light the candle. They start preparing for more oil, and a miracle happens. That's what we're told traditionally, is that candle burned the entire length of time until they got more oil. And remember, in the menorah, it was never supposed to go out in the temple. So what happened is this revival happens, it's a celebration of all these events. It's called the Feast of Lights or the Feast of Dedication, Hanukkah. And it took place on December 25th. And so rather than the menorah with the 7 candlesticks, there's the menorah of 8 candlesticks that you see more often than not representing this time of the Maccabees. So that's the time of year we're in. Well, as we look at these last few things, now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join them by intrigue, meaning as they're standing up, there are people that will help them, the Jews that were kind of half-hearted about the Greek, Hebrew, whatever, but they do so tentatively, we'll try this out. If it doesn't work, we'll go the other way sort of thing. And some of those of understanding shall fall to refine them, purify them, and make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. That's where we stop. Speaking of these that stand, it won't be easy. They'll suffer. In fact, one of the assaults by Antiochus Epiphanes during this time, he did it on the Sabbath, knowing they wouldn't be prepared. 80,000 Jews die. 40,000 prisoners he takes, 40,000 slaves. The people that stand in this time, man, do they suffer. Many die. They're purified. You know, there's a picture of just what we read in Hebrews chapter 11. And we're going to stop there because there's now a transition in the text. And I believe Daniel's seeing Antiochus Epiphanes, and it's like what you see in prophecy, those hills, the summit. He goes from there and now sees ahead to the Antichrist, who the Antiochus Epiphanes is the type of. And you'll see what I mean next week. Let's stand together. You know, we have a history lesson. As I mentioned to you last week, boy, tough text on a Sunday morning, not your typical Sunday text. But at the same time, man, it stirs me as I look around what's happening in our country. You ever have this happen to you? Sometimes I'm motivated by the news, you know what I mean? I'm like, build these radio stations, man. Let's just forget it. Let's have a holy huddle, you know? Hire more staff. Have cool little potlucks. Let's just all be happy. I suffer, you know? And then I read something in the news, and it just moves me, right? I was reading recently. I keep reading. Maybe you see it in the news. It's called the Freedom from Religion Foundation. You see it? Freedom from Religion Foundation. I keep reading about it. Recently, I read about it because out in Montana, on a ski slope, is some sort of statue of Jesus somebody put there a long time ago. Well, that ski slope is on federal land. It's just been sitting there. People appreciate it. Well, this article caught my eye. We see this happening over and over in America. But what it was, the way it was written, it caught my eye. The Freedom from Religion Foundation did this. Nobody ever complained about that statue. But you know what they did? They went out there. That's why the article is describing it. I wanted to know more about it. They went out there and interviewed people in the area to find somebody who would complain. And as soon as they found a person, they brought a lawsuit to have that thing taken down. I'm like, who are these people? I keep reading this. Well, there's a lady's name. So I go and I start researching. And it turns out it's a lady and her husband. Start reading more of the background. 1970s, she's in the United States. She's an American. And there's this whole thing fighting for women's rights. The whole abortion battle. She's very involved with it. And she says, and she's being interviewed, that back then, she noticed fighting for women's rights, people who were pro-life would show up and try to stop what she was considering against women's rights. And she says most often the people that were speaking and leading it were nuns, Christian ladies. So she said this, I decided at that point, the thing that's hurting women in America is religion. And I'm going to do everything I can to stop it. So her and her husband have dedicated their lives to it. Now they have 8 total people. Full time. And it's exactly what they're doing now. They're so brazen, they'll just go looking. Where can we find something? And we'll try to stop it. You know what happened to me when I read that article? It's happened to me many times. I'm like, Lord, let's go build those radio stations. I'll do it, man. I'll do it. I'm reading about her spending, and in the article, every single day, 7 days a week, morning and night, that she says we work all the time. I'm like, I'll do the same. I'll do the same. I hope you will too. I want my kids to know I made a stand for truth and for the Lord at such a time. Let's close in prayer. Father, I thank you for your word. I thank you for the reminder, the history lesson, but yet prophecy written by man before. I thank you there's nothing like your word. And we can study it and dig in and look at all the evidence. I thank you how we've seen it change lives one by one by one. And I thank you for the freedom that we have to gather and open it and study it at such a time. I thank you for the opportunities we have in our hands to get the Word of God out. I pray for my brothers and sisters here and myself. I pray for our faith. God, increase our faith. I pray for our courage, our boldness, and yet the love of God. It's in every way the love of God and love for others to just motivate us, Lord. And I pray you'd protect this place. But to your glory, Lord, to your glory. Thank you, Lord, for all you do in Jesus' name.
Horizon Christian Fellowship in Fitchburg, Massachusetts can be contacted online at horizonfitchburg.org or by calling 978-665-9111. Our service times are 8:45 and 11 a.m. on Sundays and 6:30 p.m. on Wednesdays.